Hi, this is Tanya Domi. Welcome to The Thought Project, recorded at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, fostering groundbreaking research and scholarship in the arts, social sciences, and sciences. In this space, we talk with faculty and doctoral students about the big thinking and big ideas generating cutting-edge research, informing New Yorkers and the world. Stanley Rinchon is a professor of political science at Lehman College and the Graduate Center, CUNY. Dr. Rinchon is also a trained clinical psychologist and psychoanalyst who has used these skills in his examination of three U.S. presidents, including George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and Donald J. Trump. He is the author of more than 120 articles in the fields of presidential politics, American immigration, national identity, American foreign policy, leadership, and political psychology. He was also trained by the University of Michigan's Inter-University Consortium for Political and Social Research. His latest volume is the subject of our podcast today, The Real Psychology of the Trump Presidency, Palgrave Macmillan 2020. Welcome to The Thought Project, Dr. Stanley Rinchon.
Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on this prodigious, highly rigorous book about the subject of the psychology of President Trump's presidency. I just want to note for our listeners that each chapter is followed by copious endnotes, which are very useful to any reader, but especially to those doing their own research. I would also add that this book is timely as the presidential election approaches in less than 53 days away. And to that note, Trump's psychological makeup is a subject seized upon by endless commentators from the political left, center, and the right. His psychology has been the subject of a few books already, including The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, edited by Dr. Bandy Lee of Yale University, and the most recent memoir of sorts by Mary L. Trump, who is also a clinical psychologist like yourself, Dr. Rinchon. Your book is quite different from the ones I just mentioned. You mentioned that your research of Trump began at the first presidential debate in the Republican primary in 2016. What fascinated you about Trump, the candidate?
Literally, there's never been a president quite like Donald Trump, and my guess is it's highly unlikely there'll ever be another one like him again. He really is the black swan of presidencies. He's unique and very consequential, and as a psychoanalyst who studies presidential leadership and a political scientist who studies the presidency, how could I not be interested? And, you know, I was. And actually, I was more than interested. I was genuinely curious and puzzled. You know, I started looking, at the presidency for this year when the convention, the first convention and nomination process started. And I actually gave an interview with somebody who now works at the Times in which I was asked about Trump. And I said, well, I didn't think he really had much of a chance to get the nomination. So there really wasn't a lot of reason to talk a lot about him. But boy, was I proved wrong.
Yes, you were, and a lot of other people, too.
No doubt about it. And, you know, as I watched, as he stumbled and sometimes roared past 17 other candidates, it was really clear to me that he was tapping into something that was really unique and that only he, of all those candidates, seemed to be able to see. And, of course, you know, once he got the nomination, then he faced a very formidable and prodigious and well-financed candidate, Hillary Clinton. And there, too, you would say to yourself, gee, you know, he's really behind the eight ball there. But he came from behind, literally, to win the election and start out on his very unique presidency. And so for somebody like myself, the puzzlement and the interest and the curiosity are really tantamount. They were helpful in another way as well, if I might mention it.
Please do.
Well, you know, my curiosity helped maintain a sense of emotional and political calm, even as, you know, anti-Trump vitriol exploded almost all around every aspect of debate about him and his latest provocations and the power center assumptions, my curiosity and my interest kept me focused. The book is as a result of that.
In your approach of the study of Trump psychology, can you explain to our listeners the theoretical framework of the book, which you organized the book and wrote the book? I think that would be of interest to people in the academy, but it is very, very different from what you would call popular trade books.
First of all, allow me to mention that I've written three other presidential biographies that are psychological in nature, one on Bill Clinton and George W. Bush and Barack Obama and now Trump. And each of those books asks really the same four basic questions. The first one is, what are the core psychological elements that define this presidency and president? And second, how did they develop over the course of his life? Because as an analyst, you want to know how things develop, not only what they are. And the third is, what are the implications of these elements for the president's ambitions and leadership styles? And last, but certainly not least, how did the country's expectations and its political circumstances shape how successful that president's leadership is possible to be? For Trump, it meant asking an additional specific question, which was, what are his real capacities and deficiencies that he brings to the presidency? And the reason it's important to just ask that basic question up front is that there are enormous numbers of observations about Trump's very real deficits around, but many of them are harsh, speculative, and, you know, honestly, devoid of evidence beyond critics' confident assertions. And so fair-minded, substantive, comprehensive, and accurate analyses of Trump and his presidency are extremely rare and therefore much needed. And I'm hopeful that I've provided, some of that in my analysis. May I say a word about the adjective that I used in the book's title?
Oh, please, yes.
Well, you know, the book's title is called The Real Psychology of the Trump Presidency. And I have to say that when I was discussing the title with the editor, I was a little uncomfortable with the use of the word real because it sounded in my mind fairly presumptuous, and I didn't like being presumptuous at all about what I was trying to do. But I came to realize that the word is meant to convey a comparison between the reductionist and the highly partisan psychological and political caricatures that permeate what is presented as Trump analysis, and that word analysis is in quotes, and an effort to consider and weigh a wide variety of information and formulating provisional theories of Trump psychology. I don't want the legitimacy of my analysis to rest on the presumption that I'm a psychoanalyst and you're not. Therefore, my words must carry some special magical weight or so. I want it to be based on the materials I bring to bear and let people make a judgment about their, you know, accuracy and the weight they should be given.
Well, that point that you've made about the title makes sense to me, having now read the book. And this is a nice segue to my next question is, how does a psychoanalyst ascertain a subject's psychology outside of traditional psychoanalysis? What were your methods of discovery? Of course, Freud is the founder of psychoanalysis, but you also point out to some other pretty well-established psychoanalysis in the field, Heinz Kohut, as a guiding thinker in your analysis of subject. And I think Kohut, who advanced self-psychology, would seem to be a perfect model in approaching an understanding of Trump. But why don't you share your thoughts with our listeners? And it's unique given that this is your third psychological profile of a president of the United States.
The first thing you have to do in starting out looking at Trump is to extricate yourself from the emotional whirlwinds that swirl around you. And then the other thing you have to do is be ready to swim against the narrative tide. And the reason I say that is because most purported Trump analyses take the form of politically purposeful narratives, not real theories. a narrative, I think you probably know, is a motivated assembly of carefully selected and proffered facts, along with their interpretation, that seek to convey a truth that's congenial for the purpose that the narrative was created to convey. So you get a lot of ubiquitous Trump buzzwords like narcissistic or unfit. And they're politicized terms which come with their own prepackaged narratives. And, of course, the reality is that narratives are not synonymous with reality and actually don't bear any a priori relationship with it. I have the thought sometimes that narrative is to truth what Kurosawa's classic movie masterpiece Rashomon is to reality. So that's what you start with. And you then have to go to getting beyond single explanations. Most of the characterizations of Trump are overly broad and deeply flawed. And what this means is that they're substantively narrow and evidentially shallow. You know, in developing these theories of Trump, I simply follow really what amounts to ordinary social science procedures. I make use of an enormous amount of primary data. I've had, you know, hundreds of interviews with him and about him stretching back into his formative years. I've carefully analyzed, you know, diverse descriptions and analyses of events in which Trump was involved to try to reach an understanding of what they mean and their impact. And then check these all out against additional data and see whether they hold or they don't hold. And as you said, it's basic social science research, even if my own theoretical framework owes much to Freud and Horney and Erickson and Coad. And of course, my two colleagues and friends and mentors, Harold Glaswell and Alex George. So one requirement of this is simply basic, good efforts at scholarship and research. And one of the things is you take a wide variety of data and you see how they assemble into patterns, and you try to see where facts fit or don't fit. And if they don't fit, you can't just ignore them. You've got to do something to try to make sense of them. I can give you a couple of examples of that if you like.
Please.
Well, for example, one of the things I always talk about with Trump is, you know, the name calling. Trump calls people by their names, you know, Slow Joe or whatever he said about the latest person he doesn't like. And that's the truth. That's real. But it's also true that Trump has been and has been documented to be extremely supportive and gracious with people. So you have these two divergent realities, and you have to try to reconcile those realities. And of course, for me, what trying to do that led to was to an analysis of what I call Trump's fight club presidency, which is to say, you know, he's a very combative man. Why is he so combative? Where did that come from? What functions does it serve? Is he always like that? Does he sometimes go overboard? In other words, I'm listening to you, all the questions that come about by simply starting out with a discrepancy. On one hand, he calls people a lot of names. On the other hand, he's very generous and supportive in many cases. So how do you reconcile that? Mm-hmm. One thing leads to another, and there you are.
Yes, there's been a lot of reporting about how charming he can be in private. And then there are, of course, lots of public instances where, as you said, he does call people names. And I would say with respect to women, it's been really, I think, probably one of the most negative aspects of his name calling. But nonetheless, you do point out the gaps and the discrepancies. With respect to Trump's psychology, one of the main issues that seems to dominate is, in fact, the accusation that he's narcissistic. And in your sixth chapter of President Trump's Narcissism Reconsidered, what did you find out about this aspect of his psychology?
You can't read three sentences about Trump without finding out that somebody thinks he's a malignant narcissist, so you could hardly avoid having to deal with that issue. And I want to make clear that, there is an element of narcissism in Trump's psychology. That much seems pretty obvious to me and, you know, probably everybody else. But the point is that the single trait is not synonymous with his overall psychology. They're not the same thing. So the question isn't whether he has narcissism in his psychology. He does. What's the nature of it? And so I spend some time in the chapter. This, to me, is a good illustration of what critics get wrong. And these are people, some of them I'm frankly very surprised at. You know, they're supposedly trained in psychology, and yet they totally ignore the difference between so-called healthy or ordinary narcissism. That's, you know, that's Kohut's version of the term.
Right.
And Kernberg's idea of pathological narcissism. And so they just conflate the distinction, for example, between Trump's business strategies. You know, this is the best steaks, the best water, the best this, the best that, and his own psychology, which is quite different. And in doing that, what they do is they miss some other very important elements of Trump's psychology that are absolutely central, and in my view, at least as, and in some cases, more central than his so-called malignant narcissism. Would you like a couple of examples?
Yes, please. Illustrate it. Yes.
Sure. Well, one is that if you spend any time analyzing Trump seriously, and I do mean that, you know, what's obvious, and the other, if I may just go for an aside for a moment, the other thing about Trump is there's so much of Trump that is so obvious. Sometimes I feel guilty calling attention to what I think is, you know, something that is so ordinary, but it, you know, it gets missed in the shuffle. Anyway, his determination. Trump is an incredibly determined guy. That's a big piece of his psychology. And if you don't discuss his determination, which nobody does, really discuss it, you've missed a lot of what's going on with him. Here's another: a willingness and capacity to fight back when attacked. Now, a lot of people don't realize there are two things involved here. One is a capacity. You know, you have to have the skills to fight back Slow Joe or whatever you want to say about whatever you want to say about. But there's a willingness. People shy away from conflict. A lot of people go to get a rundown from their advisors about what they should or what shouldn't say, what words they could use, what words they shouldn't use.
Right.
Trump is willing to stand where he sees it and say it as he sees it. And that is something that is really quite unique in a president. It's totally unusual in the modern presidents that I've studied. Here's another one. Number three, if you want. An incredible work ethic and the ability to get things done. He's amazing. One of the best biographies of him, you know, was astounded at the work ethic of he and his father, and said, you know, you can't spend 5 minutes without realizing how hard these guys work all the time. And it's incredibly true. And Trump has a get things done mentality. Now, sometimes that leads him, you know, off the garden path, so to speak. But a lot of times it's very purposeful, and it allows him to do things that no one else has either tried or been successful in doing. And now, if you don't mind, I'll just give you one more thing that came out to me.
Of course.
Came out to me as I was, you know, researching this. Trump is more than occasionally, and I spent a lot of time with Trump over the last 3 years, believe me. He's more than occasionally a thoughtful, out-of-the-box intelligence applied to realizing his personal and political ambitions. First of all, he's totally not stupid. That's totally wrong. But he thinks out of the box. He, in part, it's because he doesn't know enough to think the way he ought to think, ought in quotes, but he's genuinely curious about basic questions. And those basic questions get him into areas which lead him to be quite different. And I think that's part of what he brings to a presidency. So those are some things that get lost in the shuffle when people, you know, sort of repeat endlessly, you know, like parrot lemmings, pathological narcissism. They lose sight of the other things that are there to analyze. And so we don't get a good picture of Trump. We get a caricature.
Some of your citations, I mean, you point to a CIA officer who said, you know, to some extent, every leader in the world has a propensity to have some narcissism, because in order to thrive and create a life and to go for something at such a high level, in his case, from a business background with no professional political experience per se, he went for the top rung, and that you would have to be at some level, every person who runs for president is going to have a certain level of narcissism that's within the normal range. Is that true?
My guess is, I've not seen a study that confirms it, but I would think it would be true. I think presidents differ from ordinary people in having a lot higher level of ambition and purpose and desire. Ordinary people don't often aspire to be presidents, but the people who are running for that office see themselves in that role and want to be, and that sets them apart. But you know, even among presidents, and I have made this point in another of my writings, there are gradations of ambition even among presidents. Some really want to just, you know, do well. Others want to set the world on fire. They want to be transformational. Barack Obama was somebody who wanted to be transformational. Trump wants to be transformational in his own way. So even among presidential ambitions, there are varying levels. And for me, Trump and Obama are two examples of the top highest tier. Now, that doesn't mean that either Trump or Obama are malignant narcissists. That just means they have incredibly high levels of ambition and desire to leave a particular kind of mark in the world and in history.
So, speaking of which, you talk about Trump wanting to really perform highly and probably even change the presidency. And with that regard, you elaborate on Trump seeking a main focus of his presidency seems to be a set of policies that are labeled American Restoration. And you spend an ample amount of time in the book spelling out this eight-pillared array of policies that he seems to be addressing, going after, and as you say, is very persistent and he fights for it. Do you want to elaborate on his American Restoration agenda?
I do, and I want to put it into the context of what I call Trump's two presidential purposes. One is presidential and the other is personal. The presidential is the politics of American Restoration. And, you know, a basic way to understand that is that he wants to take the conventional assumptions, the conventional narratives that have governed public policy for the last 40 years among Democratic elites and Republican elites and independent elites, and he wants to change them. And he wants to change them so they reflect what he considers to be a more accurate reality and that they more fully fulfill their purposes, which is to make the American Republic a good place to be and to grow up and to aspire to reach all your dreams. And so, you know, a couple of illustrations are pretty obvious. First of all, the whole idea of trade. And for many years, people said, you know, trade is great. More trade is better. There's no downside. It's win, win, win. And of course, underneath of that, a lot of things were happening that were not so good. And my favorite illustration of the change that Trump has brought about is that in foreign policy, which, as you know, because I know you follow it, which is a sort of terrific, you know, elite journal, two of the people who were championing that wrote an article saying, well, you know, we probably were mistaken in not spending enough time thinking that there were other aspects to trade other than it's always good. And so they were essentially publishing a mea culpa, but saying, you know, well, to rescue real trade, fair trade, as Trump calls it, we really have to acknowledge that there are two sides to the coin. So that's one big thing. Immigration is another. For many, many, many years, people have been saying the more immigration, the better. The more, the better. There's no downside. And Trump has been saying that you need to have standards. You need to have ideas about what kind of immigration you want. And he made what, to me, I follow immigration a fair amount, made the very simple point that you should have some skills-based immigration in the mix, as do Britain, the European Union, Australia, New Zealand, Canada. We're not the only country who's been doing that. So that's all he's saying. He's not saying get rid of immigration. He's not anti-immigrant. is trying to just reform immigration so that it fits more fully into America's needs. And that's another big element that people have never questioned, and that's what Trump is doing. And I list those areas, I think six or seven.
Yes, you do.
Whatever they are.
The courts, you mentioned the courts too, and economic growth, obviously.
He's trying to reform the system. It really is transformational, and something that occurred to me during the pandemic, which I hadn't thought about before, which is Trump is also trying to reform the international institutions that govern American life in some way. I'll give you an example, like WHO or, you know,
NATO.
NATO, WTO.
Right.
He's not trying to get rid of them. He's trying to reform them. Or in the United States, the CDC, which screwed up fairly well on the testing issue right off the bat, or the FBI. He's not abolishing them. He's trying to reform them so that they function in the way that they are meant to function and do better in the work that they're proposing to do. And so the politics of American restoration is a huge, enormous undertaking. And it's against the grain of a lot of different people who are connected to the way things used to be. They're going to fight like hell. That's understandable. You would expect that to happen. I don't know if we have enough time, but that dovetails to me with his more personal purpose in life, which I argue has changed pretty dramatically.
Let me just say that, would you concede that perhaps the way he pursues these changes have been counterproductive? I will just point to the instance of locking up children at the border. I mean, this has become such a fraught issue. And polling data suggests that he will lose voters on this issue. Particularly white women with degrees are probably just not going to go for this. People are appalled by it. I don't really want to debate about changing and renovating, because that always happens. I would argue, because you do point out that he is a fighter, he fights for what he believes in. And you make also the point that you believe he ran for recognition and respect. But it would also seem there's a downside to this character, propensity to fight and then to, you know, try to roll over and achieve it. But it has backfired on him, has it not?
Well, I think that I don't find Trump either flawless or perfect.
Sure.
And I detail in the book a number of places where I think he has gone off the road. And, you know, he can be very impatient, and the impatience tends to get him into trouble sometimes. But the counter question to you, or to anybody who holds the feeling of, well, you know, this fight club presidency, wouldn't he have been better being more quote-unquote normal? And I think the answer to that is, go back to what he's trying to do. He's got these large areas of public and international life he wants to change. They have a lot of people, both Republican and Democratic and independent, who think that's the only way to go because that's what they think, and, you know, they're sticking to it. And so he's got to fight against that. And, of course, they believe he's the devil incarnate, and they will take any means necessary. And I list those in my book. I have a whole list of these things that were done that, you know, when you assemble them in one place, is fairly astounding. So that's
sure
what he's up against. And so the question is, you know, if you have those ambitions and you think you've been elected legitimately, which he has, in my view, and you are legitimately, therefore, tasked with putting your ideas into process, then what do you do when people come at you 24/7 from every corner and nook with things that range from calling you a traitor to calling your wife a prostitute? And just add to the list, what do you do? If you don't fight back, you are done. And has Trump made mistakes? No doubt. I'd be the first one to say so. And I won't even tell you about, oh, you got to break a few eggs to make an omelet or something like that.
Sure.
The mistakes do not define his efforts.
Fair enough. I think we'll end there on this first podcast. We are going to continue with a second one. Thank you so much, Stanley Rinch on for this conversation, and it's going to continue. I want our listeners to know we will have a part two.
Thank you. Very nice to talk with you. I appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning into The Thought Project, and thanks to our guest, Professor Stanley Rinch on of Lehman College and the Graduate Center, CUNY.
The Thought Project is brought to you with production, engineering, and technical assistance by Kevin Wolf of CUNY TV. I'm Tanya Domi. Tune in next week.